Matt Burrows of the Atlantic Council is author of the book, The Future Declassified, Megatrends That Will Undo the World Unless We Take Action. And Matt is former counselor at the National Intelligence Council. Matt, you're writing this book as a kind of a new presentation of the Global Trends document. What is that document, Matt, and who reads it?
Well, the Global Trends document is produced every 4 years by the National Intelligence Council. And so the National Intelligence Council sits at CIA headquarters. It actually reports to the Director of National Intelligence, who is the president's principal intelligence advisor. It is made up, it's a high-powered group made up very small in terms of the larger intelligence bureaucracy. And it's made up of people who have a lot of experience looking really long-term, helping the president on a day-to-day basis think about what are the likely consequences of his policies. Every 4 years, the NIC, that's what we call it, puts together a longer-term perspective to help the next administration. And when we're doing it, we actually don't know if it's going to be a Democratic or Republican administration. But what we're hoping is, and I think increasingly this has been the case with the publication, it's used throughout the government, just not at the highest echelons, to think about, well, what policies do they need to put in place to actually deal with some of the, you know, bad trends that we see, as well as also favor, reinforce the more positive trends.
To what level of granularity are you trying to get when you're writing and thinking and briefing officials on trends that you expect to see?
It's pretty, you know, we want to get down to specifics so we can give them some concrete idea. I mean, this is always a challenge because in some sense, I mean, this is 10 to 15 years out. So it's not just not the next 3 to 5 years, which is the normal kind of perspective for the NIC work. So you're trying to be as specific as possible. I used a model, actually one developed by Professor Barry Hughes out at the University of Denver, to actually give that much more specific information. So obviously there's kind of a band, spectrum of possible futures. I mean, you have to give them some idea of the highs and the lows in that. But they really like the fact if you can say, you know, how many millions of people are going to be lifted out of poverty. I mean, give some idea of that.
Mm-hmm. The Global Trends editions produced by the NIC so far, 5 of them. You were the principal author on the last 3.
That's right.
What are the trends that you've seen in those 3 documents that then are you take up in your new book?
Well, the one interesting thing, and I'll just as an aside, I mean, when I did the last one, we actually had come up to a point where we could see if we were right, since the first one was done back in the mid-90s, and that was called Global Trends 2010. So one of the, I mean, we got a lot of things right. The one thing that we always missed, and I think it is critical when you're thinking about the future, is that we underestimated the pace of change. And that is really hard, I think, for analysts. We're at this period, really, when there's takeoff in the change. I mean, what we call exponential change. It's very hard to get your mind around that. So one of the big things that I took away, and it's really something that I feel very strongly about, and that is the change in the diffusion of power. And basically the first chapter in the book features this power of one, and that is really how individuals now have enormous powers, some of it related to the increased prosperity. So, you know, we have hundreds of millions of Chinese, Indians, others around the world who are being lifted up out of poverty. They now have the means, really, of a lot of material gains, so they can buy houses, cars and so on, but they're also saving for their children's education. They now can actually, and with new technologies, particularly the internet, they can have huge impact. Are a big challenge for governments around the world, actually. And I think that is the big dimension that has happened. So obviously for government, it's still kind of a world of states. But I think in many ways what they have not appreciated is now it's a world of so many different actors, a lot of them with powers that come up to those of states.
You put a couple of things on the table there, Matt, that I want to hit on, because they connect to something that you write in the introduction to this book. I've grown more and more concerned, you write, that we Americans are not planning for the future. Part of that may be ignorance about the sheer magnitude of the developments unfolding. And it seems to me that connects with the idea of the growing middle class, which I'll ask you about in just a moment, that seems to be surprising a lot of people, especially with the focus on global poverty that we've seen in the development community inside the American government. And the other idea of that is the idea of our station in the world relative to the other countries, which I want to follow up on. But do you see anything that's addressing that concern, anything that you see as maybe a green shoot that will assuage that concern when you come back to look at these in the future?
And you're talking about assuage the concern of we're
that
not
we're still
really,
not planning for the future as well as we should.
Well, I think there has been some change, you know, since 2008 financial crisis. We didn't have the recovery that everybody had hoped for and many thought would happen. So I think there is an understanding. When I go out and lecture a lot, and this is really one reason I wrote the book, I get this sense from a lot of people that they know something is wrong. It's not quite what they had in mind as they're growing up, which was, you know, a very strong America that still seemed to be very dominant in the world. And some of that, you know, some of that is really fear. Some of it also comes from the fact that the middle class here in the U.S. has not done that well. You know, that's the interesting contrast. And they can't imagine that there are other middle classes that are actually doing very well and other middle classes that are very optimistic about the future.
You cite a stat in this book about the middle class. Over the next couple of decades, the majority of the world's population won't be impoverished, and the middle classes will be the most important social and economic sector. And considering that strikes me as one of the things, as I mentioned, I tie that back to the planning for the future, because we seem to be hyper-focused on global poverty and the implications for the geopolitical structure in the next 20 to 30 years, rather than the fact that the overwhelming number of people with which we'll come into contact will be middle-class people, and that requires a different set, maybe, of conceptions, notions, ways that we'll want to approach them as far as doing business and interacting with them.
Yes, I think first, you know, this is a pleasant surprise, and when we think about the future, we should also be thinking about some positive things, just not the negative, which tends to be in government what you focus on, but. You know, one of the positives is this surprise. I mean, that you've lifted so many out of poverty. A lot of it has to do with China, but you see it everywhere around the world. And I do think it's a different, it offers, I think, huge opportunities for Americans. Now, I think American businesses are understanding that. A lot of their profits now really are overseas, not at home. But, you know, in terms of if you look at the polling, people admire U.S. values. They don't necessarily admire what we do. Obviously, in the Middle East, huge problems with our support for Israel in most of the Arab states. But generally, I mean, they like the fact we're a very innovative society, the one that is producing all these new gadgets. And they also like the fact that we support human rights. Obviously, you know, our record isn't unblemished on that score. But if you look over time, I mean, there's quite a bit of pro-Americanism. And I would say that, you know, they want our lifestyle. And that has some unfortunate things. That means everybody wants a car. And we're seeing that in China. But that is also a reflection that, you know, our culture is very powerful.
You mentioned looking for the positives. And I was struck by the tone of this entire book, all 250 pages or so, at the overwhelming majority of it being positive. When you look around the world today, where we are in vis-a-vis foreign policy, as we sit here, you know, second week of September 2014, one might not think that the United States is in a particularly advantageous position, foreign policy-wise, and regarding our standing in the world. But you strike a very optimistic tone throughout this. Why do you continue to have that optimistic view of where America sits and the potential that we have over the next 20 to 30 years?
Well, I think a lot of it is the in terms of the value, in terms of really what we would call soft power, and also the innovation that you see. It's probably a cliche, but I think a cliche with some truth in it, that, you know, the strength of America is really outside of the beltway, I mean, in this broader society. What I have been disturbed by is the sort of pessimism you see. I was very struck. I was lecturing once up at Penn State, these engineering class, they have pretty good prospects, but they were very down on the future of the world. I gave them three scenarios to vote on, and they all voted for the most pessimistic, except for two or three people. And that seemed to me that, you know, we need to get out of that funk. I mean, we need to think about, you know, our positives and what way we can grapple with the new world. I do think, you know, and I've often talked this way, that I think there's a new game out there. I think America won't win if it plays, you know, the old game so much, but we have lots of cards really to play in this new game, which involves a lot more characters and actors.
You write about two concepts in this book that are widely perceived as negatives, but you propose that we shouldn't think about them as negatives. One of them is the concept of a multipolar world. And you write, today's multipolar world is part of the U.S. dream, and we should glory in it. What is a multipolar world? Define that term, and then define why it shouldn't scare us.
Well, multipolar world is basically where you have multiple states, who are also very powerful. You know, it is not what we called in the 90s a unipolar world where the U.S. is dominant. So you have states, I mean, China would be probably people know about the most. I mean, that's the second largest economy in the world. It's probably going to be the biggest economy in just a few years' time, surpassing the U.S. But you have other centers. You have Europe, you have Russia, you have India, and there's multiple now actors. If you think of the world now as G20, I mean, after the financial crisis, and this is probably the best illustration, I mean, President Bush at the time when they had the summit in Washington, I mean, he couldn't just bring the G7 together. So the G7, the old Western powers, they had to bring in the newer powers because that was the only way to really attack this financial crisis.
Has that been intimidating in your view in the intelligence and diplomatic communities? It doesn't seem to be bothering the defense community as much, but my sense is that that has been more difficult to reconcile for the diplomatic and intelligence communities.
I think so. I mean, first, you know, it's a far easier world when you have just a few people around the table. I mean, you know, just to organize the G20 is actually G23, I think, because they couldn't leave off a few people, mm-hmm. and the European Union wanted representation. So basically, It's a much harder thing to do, is to have those relationships. And I think in the intelligence world, you know, things are very bilateral. I mean, it's just not even dealing with, you know, at most five, which are the Five Eyes, but beyond, even within the Five Eyes, there are different gradations. And obviously, it's very one-on-one because you're very worried about whatever intelligence that you provide them in an exchange is going to be held confidentially, and you have the same you can have the same confidence about its storage and so on. I think for diplomats also, because a lot of it is a one-on-one. And, you know, when you're dealing with such diverse actors in the world, it's very hard. It's harder. I think the military, I dispute a little bit. I think China is beginning to spook them, particularly as, I mean, China's military expenditures now are growing rapidly. They have a big budget now because of where they stand. So that is beginning to disturb some, and particularly now that China seems to be rather aggressive in its own neighborhood.
Matt Burrows of the Atlantic Council's new book is called The Future Declassified: Megatrends That Will Undo the World Unless We Take Action. Another term that you use in this book and that you've used in the global trends documents that you produced is the term relative decline. Vis-a-vis the United States. I understand the word decline anywhere near the United States makes people in the community in which you live a little bit jumpy. What was the response when you first used that term? And how is the perception of how you used it different than what you actually intended in the documents, Matt?
Well, you know, as I relate in the story, when I was doing the last global trends, it was a time when President Obama in his State of the Union had made this strong statement that we're not in decline. And so there was a lot of, some direction too from the White House that, you know, decline was not a word that they wanted to see written about and used that much. And I just didn't see how you get away from talking about relative decline, which is essentially that you have China, India, others rising. And that if you look at the, you know, particularly if you look at world GDP, I mean, if China takes a larger share, somebody else is going to be loser. Now, what people don't realize necessarily is that pie is getting bigger and bigger. So the fact that we are in relative decline actually is not a bad thing. And this goes back to your earlier quote from the book that it means that others actually are doing better, and that is a, you know, for us, that's a good thing. I mean, that's the American dream on steroids, in a sense, I mean, for everybody. And we, again, should revel in it because we've created this world. And it is a different world than you think of in the 19th century, which was a more zero-sum world. Somebody was a winner, somebody was a loser. And we created greatest generation, so to speak, created that framework so that others can rise.
It strikes me that idea should be particularly appealing to people who don't want the United States to bear the full brunt of military operations, diplomatic efforts, and development efforts around the world either. You would like other people, other countries, to be capable of joining coalitions with the United States to do all three of those things.
Yes, I think the worry there, and I would share some of that worry, is that you're going to have this period of kind of transition, because a lot of these countries, if you take China again as an example, but it can also be India, you know, their collective GDP is growing, and it's going to be, you know, bigger than all the old established countries, including the U.S. But individually, the GDP per capita is still at a fairly minimum level, what we would think of as at most lower middle class. So it means that those in those countries, if you're an individual in those countries, your perspective oftentimes is that you're still, you know, digging yourself out of this impoverished background. You have these high expectations for particularly for your children. You're not thinking about necessarily the global challenges. But I think, you know, we've seen a lot of progress now on China, for example, on, you know, reducing its carbon output. I mean, and believing that they actually do have to think about the environment, particularly their own. I think you'll see huge amount of cleanup because you have a middle class there in Beijing that doesn't want to go around with a mask on them over their mouths all the time. But it is this period of the U.S. still may be carrying this pretty heavy load for a while. And at the same time, we have a lot of domestic problems at home that we think we would like to actually attack.
You wrap this book with something that you did not do in the Global Trends documents that you produced for the National Intelligence Council. And that is you propose some alternative worlds, some fictional scenarios for readers to consider. What was your reason for doing that, and what do you hope readers will take away from those fictional scenarios that you've created?
Well, I think people like stories. I mean, I think that's the way we actually learn. And, you know, analysis is useful. You can get a lot of information across to somebody in a very short amount of time. But I think actually the stuff that you remember is the stuff that comes out of narratives. And you think, you know, people think in terms of anecdotes. They know this person. They know this trait. So the effort here was to really do a fictional story. It is about certain ideas, about certain futures, but you have real characters that people can identify. They're characters that were based on some of the people I knew or encountered. So that can bring home a little bit the lessons of these different futures that may be out there for us. And of course, the subtitle of the book is Undoing Megatrends, Undoing the World Unless We Take Action, and really the emphasis on taking action. So in a sense, it's to show that there are these other ways the world could go. We have to be careful to go in the more optimistic ways. And we have two optimistic scenarios there described, two pessimistic ones.
It's a terrific book. I congratulate you on it. I thank you for sharing it with me, and I thank you for your time today, Matt.
Well, it's been my privilege to be with you.